I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. The IRS gave $4 billion in federal income tax refunds to fraudulent filers in 2012. This year, Attorney General Eric Holder said the scale, scope, and execution of these fraud schemes have grown and that tax scams are carried out by identity thieves, tax return preparers, even illegal drug gangs. With tomorrow being tax day, we asked Aaron Arvidlund, financial columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, to join us, tell us what to be on the lookout for. Aaron, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, good morning, Marty.
Good morning. Why is this a growing problem?
Well, identity theft has been a problem not just for the IRS, but for business. I mean, we've seen that with the Target breach, Neiman Marcus. So it's a problem basically where every money is involved.
And if people are filing their tax returns online, and we know that millions of people do these days, are they safe filing online?
They are safe filing online, but here's the thing. A lot of times taxpayers are misled because they get emails or they get phone calls or they're contacted through social media websites by someone posing as an IRS employee. And let's just start off by saying that the IRS does not initiate contact with taxpayers by email or by phone. They do not call. They do not email. So if you get this kind of a contact, then you can pretty much be assured right away that you might be the victim of identity theft.
So the IRS will contact you only by snail mail. That's what you're saying, Aaron?
That is correct. Only by old-fashioned snail mail.
And what are people that are being contacted online or even by phone, what are some of the come-ons?
Oh, gosh. There's all kinds of crazy scams out there. Some of them are saying, you're owed back taxes, or particularly the elderly and also those who maybe are illegal immigrants are being told that if they don't file, they could be deported or they'll have their Social Security benefits compromised. But the point is that if someone calls from the IRS, they're not from the IRS. So hang up the phone and either call your accountant or maybe call the local police department.
Well, I was going to ask you, if you get one of these phone calls or emails, what should you do about it?
Absolutely.
Call the cops?
You can call the local police. There is a program that the Internal Revenue Service operates where they can share information. But you can also call the agency directly. The IRS has an identity protection unit. It's something that they've set up in the last few years. And I'm certain if you give them a chance, they will help you out. There's a phone number, 800-908-4490. That's the IRS Identity Protection Specialized Unit at 1-800-908-4490.
You mentioned the elderly and illegal immigrants. They tend to be the targets for these scammers?
Well, they're the most vulnerable, but let's face it, we're all vulnerable. It's just that those who are a little less tech savvy or maybe have, a language problem or are worried about their citizenship might be more vulnerable to these kinds of come-ons. But there are people who are getting scammed every day, and there's a couple of things you can do to minimize your chances.
Such as?
Well, don't carry your Social Security card or any documents with your Social Security number on it. You can also check your credit report every 12 months to see if there's been any suspicious charges, maybe somebody who's gotten access to your personal information. And finally, just don't give your personal information over the phone or on the internet unless you initiated the contact and you're sure you know who you're dealing with. So don't take any calls from, a Verizon or Microsoft or anyone else, especially those shopping credit card companies, and unless you've initiated the call.
And the idea of don't carry your Social Security number around with you just in case you lose your wallet or your wallet gets stolen, something like that?
Absolutely. And also one final tip. A lot of CPAs tell me that they don't actually include their customer or their client's Social Security number on the check. They just put their last four digits when they're mailing in the tax returns because it's really up to the government to match that up with your tax filing. So that's another way to prevent ID theft.
You know, I was at the doctor's office recently, and I'm pretty sure they asked me for my Social Security number. Am I supposed to give it to them?
Yeah, so this is a problem because you know, in some cases you have to identify yourself so that your medical records and your benefits won't be stolen by somebody else. But then a healthcare employee could use that information. I generally tell people that I don't give out my Social Security number unless it's absolutely necessary. There are other ways that they can identify me, with a license or, if necessary, a passport number. But it's a real problem.
And by license, you mean something like a driver's license?
That's right.
How about giving out date of birth? Is that something we should be careful about? And I mean, we are talking about the fact that there are so many potential problems for filing taxes, but are we too sort of loosey-goosey with our DOB?
Absolutely. Any personal information can be used. You know, if I go to, let's say, the mall, and I'm asked for my phone number and my date of birth, using that, somebody unscrupulous could try and find out what my Social Security number is, and you know, and then they're off to the races. So really, really hold on to that stuff.
And that's Erin Arvidlund. She's a financial columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer, the first of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about tax fraud, and as we all know, tomorrow is tax day. If you have any questions or comments, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes at whyy.org, or you can send us a tweet at whyy Radio Times. Erin, I think people might be surprised that illegal immigrants, people that are working and living in the country illegally, some of them are filing their federal tax returns.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you know, people who want to stay in the country generally, I think, you know, want to make their contribution, and filing taxes is a way to establish also a credit report. That's why checking your credit reports to see if you've got any unusual activity sometimes can be a tip-off about identity theft.
How do you know if your ID has been stolen? Is it you just all of a sudden you see things that just, you know, you were not a part of?
Sure. Check your bank statement. Check your credit card statements. Some people, actually, some identity experts have said that they change their credit card numbers every year just as a, you know, an added precaution. It's free, and you can ask your credit card companies to do it for you. And there's no reason why you can't take extra precaution and feel good about the fact that you're protecting yourself, because really it can be a life-altering event for your identity to be stolen.
Eric Holder talked about, I guess, some of these illegal tax return preparers. What should taxpayers be on the lookout for?
Oh, sure. Anyone who is not registered as a CPA, and also sometimes I think it's actually easier to file yourself, you know, using Free File or TurboTax or any of these free software programs, because then there's no third party between you and the IRS. You're always taking a chance when you're going through a preparer.
So if there's kind of a fly-by-night office that's opened up down the street, don't use it?
Unless you know the person very well, I wouldn't.
Holder also talked about the fact that, or I guess the IRS was saying something like $4 billion in federal income tax refunds to fraudulent filers a couple of years ago. Does that surprise you?
No, not at all. This is why the IRS came out this year with all the publicity about how to prevent identity theft, because they're realizing that because they don't interact over the phone or on social networks, they really have no way of fighting this unless they get the word out there that it's going on.
We have a comment from Mark. The IRS won't contact you by phone, then why do they ask you for your phone number when you file? Erin?
Great question.
It is a great question.
Yeah, again, they have their own identity theft unit, which you can call toll-free, but you have to make contact with the IRS.
So even if they're not going to contact you, they still need your phone number?
Yeah. Don't ask me how these bureaucracies work, but like I said, a lot of CPAs suggest that you only put the last four digits of your Social Security number, which is another way to protect your identity.
I have to say that our second guest just rubbed her fingers together saying collections. It's a collection. That's why they want it. I do want to see if I can squeeze in a couple of callers before we have to say goodbye to you, Erin. I would assume you would suggest that people shred their personal documents as well. Have a shredder available to when you're getting rid of old tax returns things like that.
Absolutely. It's really recommended that you hang on to your old tax returns for several years. But for instance, there are other things you can do. Downloading free apps on your phone, like Flashlight, for instance, is one way that online identity thieves have been able to get your personal information.
Really?
Yes, absolutely. By downloading free apps, a lot of times you give permission to copy all your contacts, record your calls, and harvest your credit card data. Another thing is when you're creating, passwords, a lot of times it's better to create a passphrase, like a person, time, and a place, and not your mother's maiden name because that's too easy to find. Again, you can call even the local FBI field office. They can come out to your home or your business for education courses. And one final suggestion is sometimes under your homeowner's insurance policy or your credit union, you can find out about identity theft coverage. Sometimes it's included under your homeowner's insurance policy.
Oh, that's good to know. Let me get a caller in before we have to say goodbye. This is Sheila from Chestnut Hill. Sheila, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, I'm concerned because we've just been warned not to carry our Social Security card with us. However, if you travel as a senior on SEPTA, your Medicare card has your Social Security number on it.
Mm-hmm.
Can we make photocopies and still use that Medicare card on the buses, or will they not accept that?
I don't see why not. If you have any other form of ID, like a driver's license, that shows that you're a senior citizen, I don't understand why, you wouldn't be able to use that.
Right. Sheila, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Erin, have you filed your taxes yet?
I filed an extension this year.
Oh, you did? You needed a little extra time?
That's right.
And just any final words to our listeners before we have to say goodbye in terms of just what to be aware of or what to beware of?
Again, if you are identity theft starts mostly with incoming phone calls or emails, sometimes even a fake jury duty service, even a fake funeral notice. Cyber crooks will steal the names and logos, and they send these notices by email that appear to be invitations for a friend or acquaintance funeral. Don't click on those links. You might be downloading, malware onto your computer. So, again, your personal information, it's the one and only thing that belongs to you, so hang on tight.
Well, Erin Arvid Lund, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times. It looks like, based on the phone calls here, we could have gone on. Thanks a lot for joining us.
All right, thank you.
You're welcome. Financial columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. We're going to take a very short break, and then we do have a second guest waiting in the wings. She'll be able to actually talk out loud as opposed to whispering to me. We'll be talking about what same-sex marriage has to do with tax returns. That's coming up next after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Support for WHYY comes from Nemours Alfred I. DuPont Hospital for Children in Wilmington, Delaware, where the hospital's new expansion offers the promise of hope and healing to children and their families. Opening this fall, it will include a state-of-the-art emergency department, spacious private rooms, and a nurturing healing garden. Designed by families, for families, it offers advanced pediatric care and peace of mind. More information at Nemours.org. Nemours Alfred I. DuPont Hospital supports WHYY.
When Giorgio Moroder layered Donna Summer's vocals over the synth beats on I Feel Love, he knew it was the start of something big.
This great voice, very soft and melodic, had that big contrast with the metallic sound of the synthesizers. That combination worked quite well.
The godfather of disco, Giorgio Moroder, joins us this week on Sound Opinions.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Have you ever been stuck in a conversation with someone and had no idea what to say?
We believe that if you can quell that inner panic enough to actually tap into your curiosity, there's always a million things to talk about in any situation.
What to talk about next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
People are talking.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Last year's Supreme Court ruling that struck down the Defense of Marriage Act meant that gay and lesbian couples could get federal benefits. But since some states have legalized same-sex marriage and some have not, that has created confusion for couples who are filling out their tax forms. We asked Rosalind Such to clear things up. She's a CPA with Drucker and Scaschetti here in Philadelphia, also known as the Tax Warriors. And Rosalind Such, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. So let's go back to the summer of, 2013, when the Supreme Court made its ruling and the IRS and the Treasury Department also made their rulings about couples that are married.
Mm-hmm. On June 26th, the Supreme Court ruled the Section 3 of the Defense of Marriage Act was unconstitutional, and shortly thereafter, the president quickly indicated that he wanted the federal agencies to follow the state of celebration as far as recognizing same-sex marriages. And that's really important, and we'll get into it a little bit more when we talk about states. But he urged all the agencies that had more policy-driven rules about the definition of marriage to choose the state of celebration to define the same-sex marriage issue. And the IRS followed suit. So on August 19th of 2013, they issued Revenue Ruling 2013-17, which became effective on September 16th of 2013.
And what we're talking about is that couples that are married, same-sex couples that are married, are treated like married couples.
They absolutely are.
As far as the federal government is concerned.
As far as the Internal Revenue Service is concerned. Right.
So what does that mean for couples?
That means after September 16th of 2013, they had to file with a married filing status, whether it be jointly or separately.
And if you're living in a non-marriage equality state like Pennsylvania, where we are now, what does that mean for a gay couple?
It means that you're going to file a joint return for federal, and you're going to file separate returns for the state purposes. You're going to actually file choosing the single filing status. And we've had some taxpayers attach statements indicating they are indeed not single, that they are legally married, because if you think about it, when you sign a return, you're signing under penalties of perjury, and you're literally being forced to say something false, that you're single when you are technically legally married. But unfortunately, because Pennsylvania doesn't recognize same-sex marriage, that's the way that they're directing same-sex couples to fill out their return.
So you've got these two forms. One is the federal form. So the federal government says that but you have to be married, right? It doesn't apply to domestic partnerships.
Or civil unions.
Or
correct.
Civil unions.
You must be legally married.
So if you got married in Massachusetts, let's say, but you live in Pennsylvania, you get the federal benefits, but you don't get, obviously, the state benefits.
Correct. Well, in Pennsylvania in particular, there's no real benefit from filing jointly. We're a unique state. We have a very unique taxing structure. It's very frustrating to people that don't do a lot of Pennsylvania returns. But many other states, and there's a lot of non-marriage equality states that start their income tax calculation from the federal. So what happens is taxpayers really have to provide three federal returns. So they prepare a joint one that they file with the IRS,
right.
And they have to separate and file two single, or not file, but prepare two single federal returns so that they can then prepare their state separate returns. It's very complicated.
It is. How many states now have marriage equality?
I don't know the number off the top of my head.
It's 20-something?
Yeah, 26. I'm sorry, mm-hmm. I didn't have that ready off the top of my head.
And then we do have some states that have civil unions and some that recognize domestic partnerships. But for tax purposes, those don't necessarily qualify.
Correct. There are some states that allow for civil union couples to file jointly. But each state has different guidance. I gave you a chart to look at earlier. It's a 3-page chart that we prepared, which goes through each non-marriage equality state, any state that does not allow for the legality of same-sex marriage, and what their guidance is for taxpayers, how to file their returns.
And generally speaking, do couples pay less taxes if they file jointly? Generally speaking?
It's hard to say generally speaking because every taxpayer is different. So generally speaking, if there's a couple where one spouse makes a lot more income than the other spouse, they generally will pay less tax by filing jointly. If they make about the same income, or if they're both make a good amount of income, they're likely in a marriage penalty situation in which they would actually pay more tax by filing jointly.
Oh, interesting.
Sometimes the penalties of equality, I guess.
That you end up paying more. But are you required by the federal government if you are married? Are you required to file jointly or you can choose?
You can file married filing separately, but that is not a filing status that would create less tax on for most people.
Let me reintroduce you. That's Rosalind Such. And again, she's a CPA with Drucker and Scicchetti here in Philadelphia. And we asked her to join us to bring some clarity to the fact that the Supreme Court ruled last summer that the portion of the Defense of Marriage Act was illegal, which allowed gay and lesbian couples to get some federal benefits. But part of the confusion, of course, is that some states have are marriage equality states and some are not. We'd love to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Just to make sure, we're in Pennsylvania now, which is we have our own DOMA here in this state.
Mini DOMA, yes, that's what it's referred to.
A mini DOMA. Delaware?
Is a marriage equality state.
And New Jersey?
Is a marriage equality state.
Maryland?
Marriage equality state.
Okay. And New York?
New York is. Okay. New York was the Windsor case that the Supreme Court ruled on in June was precipitated out of New York.
And what did the Windsor case, that was a significant case. What's sort of at the heart of that particular case?
At the heart of that case was estate taxes. So Edie Windsor had filed on behalf of her spouse who had passed away because she was unable to take advantage of the marital deduction that opposite-sex couples are afforded. And until the Supreme Court ruling, same-sex married couples were not allowed to take advantage of that, which basically means that you can transfer your estate tax-free upon the death of your spouse or to your spouse.
And that was really groundbreaking.
It was groundbreaking. And boy, how exciting for us tax lawyers to have a huge civil rights case founded on taxation.
That doesn't happen every day.
No,
does it?
It doesn't.
What about things like health benefits? I mean, especially if you get them through your employer, how does that factor into what we've been talking about?
This has been a big issue. So basically, prior to the Windsor case, employers were required to impute income for health benefits for partners. So if we were married and my employer provided health benefits for you, prior to Windsor, I would have paid tax on the amount of benefits that they provided to you, like for whatever they paid for your premiums.
Right.
And not only income tax, but also payroll tax, which means it was actually costing employers more, too, because remember, payroll taxes are paid half by employers, half by the taxpayer.
So that really that was a pretty dramatic difference then for...
It's a very dramatic difference because if you think about it, I see on average the cost for partners' health benefits about $10,000 a year of additional income. Mm-hmm. And if you take that, if someone was married in 2004, that's when Massachusetts was the first state to allow same-sex marriage. That's 10 years. You know, it's $100,000 of income over 10 years. It's a lot.
Have you been? Has that made things very busy at your company? The result of these rulings.
Well, I'd say we're busy all the time in tax season, but it's certainly we've seen a huge uptick in our LGBT practice. We've expanded to kind of create a whole subset of our practice to cater to the LGBT mm-hmm. community, and in fact, we created a really robust resource page on our website, taxwarriors.com/LGBT, and in that. That page has drawn a lot of traffic right. on the web and thus created a lot of new business for us, which is great.
So let's say if you are, though, married in New Jersey, but you live in Pennsylvania, so you do not get the kind of benefits that one would get in New Jersey then.
You wouldn't get the state-level benefits because right. Pennsylvania does not recognize same-sex right. marriage yet. There's a lot of cases working their way through the system now.
And the state benefits for someone living in New Jersey would be?
I'm sorry. If they lived in New Jersey instead of Pennsylvania?
Yes.
There's all different things. A lot of Medicaid and things like that are state-level benefits. And actually, Social Security looks to the state of residence. So if there was an elderly couple that right. decided to get married, maybe perhaps they were together for a lot of years, and now after Windsor, they finally could officially tie the knot. They would be unable, if they lived in Pennsylvania, or any other non-marriage equality state to receive Social Security benefits based on their spouse. However, Social Security is working with, they have put on their website, they're working closely with the Department of Justice because statutorily they define marriage between a man and a woman. So it's a little harder for them to make changes, and that's what I was referring to earlier. So what some agencies are defined by policy, which is what the IRS was able to do to change quickly through policy, but when the definition of marriage for the agency is defined statutorily, they have to go through the whole legislative process. So Social Security is working with the Department of Justice, I believe, in an effort to change their policy or their statute, so that they refer to the state of celebration with regard to the definition of marriage. But I just want to note something that's very important.
Sure.
For older same-sex couples that are looking for the benefit of Social Security, if they live in non-marriage equality states, they should apply now, even though they know for a fact at this point they will be denied, because Social Security will look retroactively back to the date of their application. So if and when this gets resolved, hopefully favorably, where Social Security will look to the state of celebration, they would be able then to get benefits back to the date that they applied.
And if we're talking about people who are married, then does it apply? You have to be married, what, before? Massachusetts goes back about 10 years, right?
2004, yeah.
Right, so it would recognize anybody that got married even before
Windsor.
Before Windsor, the summer of 2013.
Yeah, and there's another thing I wanted to point out, Marty, because it's really time-sensitive, being held at April 15th is tomorrow.
Yes, it is tomorrow.
anyone that was married before Windsor and would have been in what we call a marriage bonus situation, where they would have paid less tax if they filed jointly. So we talked about folks that were in a marriage penalty situation, but there's certainly plenty of folks that will be in a marriage bonus situation. If they were married in 2010 legally and filed separate returns, but would have paid less tax if they filed jointly, and they filed on time by April 15th of 2011, the last date to amend their return is tomorrow.
Oh, wow.
So there's kind of a ticking time bomb as far as those refunds go. So that's really important for people to be aware of.
But what you're also describing is the sheer complexity, even in states that recognize gay and lesbian marriages, that it's still a complex process to go through.
Absolutely. It's a year of transition right now. So folks that were just used to filing separately are now filing jointly. They may have used different tax preparers before for whatever reason. Maybe they had a business or maybe they did it themselves and now it's a little bit easier. But certainly a year of transition is always going to be challenging for everyone. Well, one thing though, if from an estate tax standpoint, it has simplified things significantly for same-sex couples that are married and live in marriage equality states in particular. But again, so it's transition year, they need to review all their estate documents, because now, previous to Windsor, probably all their estate documents were drafted in a way to work around the fact that they didn't have the marital deduction. So now that they do, they have to almost go back and revisit their entire estate plan and perhaps rewrite the whole thing. So it's really important that they get counsel, whether from a CPA and or a tax attorney, any kind of estate planning attorney, to help them with that.
And I don't know how many pages the IRS tax return forms are. I'm sure you do. Thousands and thousands of pages.
It feels like that.
And this is obviously a growing portion of that because of just the complexity of the law and how things are changing.
Well, with regard to this issue, what the IRS did is they issued Revenue Ruling 2013-17, and what that said is anywhere in the code that refers to marriage will now apply to same-sex married couples, you know, as long as they're legally married.
Right.
So they don't have to go back and amend all of the code, thank goodness. That would take forever. Because I believe there's over 1,000 instances in which marriage is referred to in the code. So what that did is simplified and said, you know, this revenue ruling says marriage means same-sex marriage as long as it's legal.
What are some of the questions that you and others at your office have gotten that you've been dealing with as these laws are changing?
Probably the most common question, should we get married?
Oh, really?
Yeah. Because, you know, same-sex couples, because they were not allowed to get married, a lot of them have been in committed relationships for years, decades even, and they have a very mature financial world. So now there's a true financial impact of marriage. So I would think same-sex couples that are, you know, 24, coming out of college, getting married, a lot less impact, right? They don't have a lot of assets, but there are folks I'm calling them mature in their financial role, just for lack of any better term, but there's if they file jointly, they may be in a marriage penalty situation. There's a ton of ways within the code where you could be in a worse situation, not just from the tax rate standpoint, which is where the marriage penalty saying comes from, but there's different situation in which you might be subject to the net investment income tax at a lower rate, quicker than you would have if you were filing separately. Mm-hmm. So there's a ton of things involved. So what we've been encouraging folks is to maybe do a tax rejection and see what the financial impact is. Also review other things that might be impacted from a financial standpoint, maybe FAFSA for their children.
Mm. Well, what about kids? Because I'm thinking that that's also a complicating factor, especially if you're in a non-marriage equality state, and maybe even married in another state, but living in Pennsylvania, for instance.
Absolutely. And it's funny because even those state-level issues can rise to a federal issue. So, for example, the adoption credit. The adoption credit is a very beneficial thing that's out there for folks that are willing to adopt. But for same-sex couples, a lot of them in Pennsylvania do second-parent adoption. So where one parent is the biological parent of the child, and then the second spouse would adopt that child. Well, if they're legally married, they would not be able to take advantage of the adoption credit, because the adoption credit is written in a way that says you cannot use it if you're adopting your spouse's child.
Oh, wow.
So when someone says, should we get married, one of my first questions is, are you looking to adopt, or are you looking, what are your thoughts about children if you don't already have children? Because if they could delay getting married until after, a second parent adoption, they could take advantage of a very useful credit.
I'm curious, when people ask you, should we get married, and they live in Pennsylvania, do you say yes, knowing that things might change or they might not?
There's no right answer. I think everybody's situation is different and has to be reviewed accordingly. But there's some people that they're not even worried about the financial impact, because it goes further than the dollars and cents of it all. It really goes down to the quality and love, and I totally respect that and see where people are coming from with regard to that. So every taxpayer is different.
24 hours or a little more than 24 hours before
happy hour.
Before the filing deadline. Exactly. Any final last words of advice, suggestions to our listeners?
I guess the only other, there's one other thing that's pressing for April 15th that I wanted to mention. If folks were married in 2013, same-sex couples that were married in 2013, and they perhaps over-contributed to their IRA or flexible spending account, like a dependent care benefits that they may have through their employer, if they made their contribution decision in January before they were married last year, they may have over-contributed. Huh. And the deadline to make that a withdrawal of that over-contribution is tomorrow. So they should make sure that they double-check that if they got married this year, to make sure they haven't over-contributed to those tax-deferred accounts.
Are you pulling an all-nighter tonight?
No, I think we're just about wrapped up. Everybody looked pretty happy this morning. No, not too many fires.
Well, Rosalind Such, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. She's a CPA with Drucker and Scacchetti here in Philadelphia, also known as the Tax Warriors. That's their blog. And joined us to help us understand what the Supreme Court ruling overturning the Defense of Marriage Act, what that has meant for same-sex couples. Well, coming up after this very short break, we want to know, where does all that money go? And we have Chuck Maher from the Federal Tax Policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. He'll be joining us. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Philadelphia Museum of Art proudly supports WHYY and presents Art After Five, a blend of jazz and international entertainment every Friday. This Friday, young singer, composer, and arranger Kavita Shah will incorporate elements of Indian, Brazilian, and Malian music into her jazz-based repertoire. The Philadelphia Museum of Art's Art After Five, beginning at 5:45. More details are available online at philamuseum.org.
On the next Fresh Air, how antibiotics, cesarean sections, and sanitizers are destroying the balance of the human microbiome, the massive collection of microorganisms that live in and on our bodies. We talk with Dr. Martin Blaser, who speculates that changes in the microbiome may be contributing to obesity, asthma, and allergies. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
What is wisdom? It's said we gain wisdom as we age, but as we age, our cognitive ability declines. So what's the answer? Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices in the Family, we'll talk about wisdom as we age, what it is, how to gain it, how to use it, and how to keep it. Today at noon, here on WHYY FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We've been talking about federal income taxes, and we were curious where all our money goes. We asked Chuck Maher to explain. He's director of federal tax policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. And Chuck Maher, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Oh, good morning, Marty. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. So how much money does the federal government expect to get from all our taxes this year?
Well, the taxes bring in about $2.8 trillion. And then the government will borrow about $600-700 billion, and spent, if you look at last year, spent about $3.5 trillion, which is roughly a fifth of the size of the U.S. economy.
And when you talk about $2.8 trillion, is that just federal income taxes, or are there other taxes?
No,
that we pay?
That's about half of that is federal income taxes, which is the progressive tax the U.S. federal government relies on, and about a little bit more than a third are payroll taxes, which really for working class, middle class people, that's really the higher tax. Mm-hmm. That's for Social Security, Medicare. And then corporate taxes make up about 10% of federal revenues, and then there's some cats and dogs like the estate tax, which is very small right now, and some of the excise taxes on, like, tobacco.
And we should think of them as cats and dogs?
Yeah, I guess. I wish it were, the estate tax, wish it were a bigger dog. It's been shrinking.
Indeed. Well, and it's been shrinking, why?
There has been a move since the 90s, particularly, among conservatives, a real attack on the tax, the sort of moniker, the death tax, and it's been rather effective. You know, in part, the first move was basically a trade. In 1997, basically, what President Clinton got for his deal was more health insurance for children, and Republicans, in turn, got some help for more, wealthier kids, more trust fund type kids on the estate tax. And that they've sort of pushed that, and to the point now where really, folks can inherit up to from a couple about $10 million tax free, which is. Rather, it's somewhat peculiar given what's been going on as far as the polarized income and wealth in the United States. So hopefully over time that will shift back. But right now the estate tax really is dwindling.
Well, it is. I mean, you're talking about rich kids, poor kids there, are you not?
No doubt. And that was the deal. And that's been the deal a couple of times. The last time the estate tax was expanded, in fact, the trade really was for the child tax credit for people, basically lower income, working class, people making, $15,000, and the agreement was to give them the child tax credit in return for this increase in the tax-free amount for, what wealthier families on the estate tax.
I read that the average federal tax bill is about $11,715. That would be for 2013. Does this seem about right?
That's probably a mean. That's probably a mean, so it includes some higher-income people. Right. The average middle-class family, roughly, the effective federal tax rate is about 5%. Right, so for middle class people, actually, the income tax, it's there, but it's really not a huge tax. It is really the payroll taxes that actually are a bigger tax for them.
And when you look then, sort of where the money then goes, so the money for Social Security is that the big ticket item?
Right, so that's probably the largest. I sort of divide it into fifths. And Social Security is a little bit over a fifth. And Social Security is a life insurance program, a disability program, and obviously a retirement program that gives about $1,300 a month for seniors, and is the most powerful anti-poverty program in the U.S. Right, it lifts about one third of seniors out of poverty who would be in poverty absent Social Security.
And then the number two one is what?
Yeah. So then you go to defense. Right, is roughly a fifth. And most of that's for regular operations. About a sixth of the money for defense right now is still in overseas operations for Afghanistan, which has been coming down. But defense is generally a fifth. And then the next fifth, the third fifth, is for health programs, right? So Medicare, Medicaid, and CHIP for kids is one-fifth. And then the next fifth is sort of split between interest on the debt, which right now is only 6%. Interest are very, very low. And about 12% for a safety net program. So unemployment insurance, SNAP, right, formerly known as food stamps. And also on the spending side, we actually count the earned income tax credit, which is the most powerful anti-poverty program for non-seniors. Mm. So that's the next fifth. And then finally, the last bit is really what everyone thinks of as government, right? The infrastructure spending. You think about the science spending, right? The U.S. has a world-class university system, right? You have in Philly, you have UPenn there, which the federal government provides a lot of funding for science research. Then education, veterans care, housing, all that is all wrapped up in this last fifth. Which that part of the budget has really been the one that's been squeezed lately, and I think really is at quite a bit of risk.
Well, you can see what big role the federal government plays in the country's economy.
Oh, it's huge, right? I mean, I think if you think about all of the industries, right, of computers, right, think about where the internet came from. So much of this is driven by government investments in science. If you think about the U.S. has world-class drug industry, so much of that sort of initial work on drugs flows through the NIH. It's very important to keep those investments up, and there is a bit of a risk here, particularly in that one part of the budget, this discretionary sort of arcane word, domestic discretionary spending, has really been squeezed. And if you look out a few years under all these budgets, it would really be the lowest level it's been as a share of the economy in 50 years. And I think that is quite a risk.
And that's Chuck Maher. He's director of federal tax policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. And we called him up to join us on Radio Times. Tomorrow being tax day. And we were curious about where all that tax money goes. He just gave us an outline. What do you think? Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Chuck, what's the biggest misconception about where the public thinks tax money goes?
Yeah, I think too often, I think people, it's good to be skeptical, but we sort of sometimes get beyond skeptical, get cynical, and people think that the two biggest budget items are waste, fraud, and abuse, and foreign aid. Right, I think if you ask most people how much, I think the U.S. should have a robust foreign aid program. But if you ask people how much it is, right, they probably say, many percent of the budget. Where in reality, it's less than a percent. And people have this sense of, so much money is wasted. But if you sort of walk through and say, 24% of the budget is Social Security, they say, well, that's great. Very much support Social Security. Defense budget's a fifth. Oh yeah, we want a strong military. You walk through Medicare, right? Medicare is extremely popular. Again, Medicare and Medicaid provide health care to old people, poor people. Obviously, Medicaid is controversial right now with the expansion. But, very, very popular programs. Again, another fifth. So, generally, I think the more people sort of delve into the details, see where the money goes, I think their feeling about the government tends to go up.
Well, there was that phrase of a couple of years ago, get the government's hands off my Social Security.
Yeah, exactly. I love those t-shirts. Don't touch the government, touch my Medicare, yeah.
But even picking up on the foreign aid, and I've seen reports as well that people think it's huge. Foreign aid is a very small part of the Defense Department budget, yes?
It's part of the sort of non-domestic sort of security and foreign affairs, but the overall budget, right, it's less than 1%. I mean, the U.S. is not, we arguably should spend much more. We do quite a bit, but as far as the share of the budget, it's not even a rounding error.
But when we talk about things like Social Security and the payroll taxes, is that considered part of the federal budget? I mean, only because I ask that because it's a different line item in our pay stubs.
Right, right. And so, they sort of split out. It has its own trust fund. But, for economists, they tend to like to pull it all together into a unified budget. And obviously for people, right, that comes out of their paycheck, whether it's payroll taxes or income taxes, it doesn't really matter. But what's important is to sort of bring it all together and see, how the tax, the taxes, who pays what, and to make sure you try to balance that out. We like to have, from our perspective, very much like to have a progressive federal tax system, so the higher income people do tend to pay a bit more. And they do, right, the income tax is very progressive, but that's balanced out by these payroll taxes.
Which are regressive, yes? Because it's a straight percent.
The taxes are regressive because they're capped, right? So everybody pays the same rate, but higher-income people stop paying Social Security taxes at a certain point, about $110,000. Now, the benefits, though, are progressive, generally, right? So,
right.
But overall, but yes, the taxes are, those taxes tend to be regressive. Excise taxes tend to be regressive. And then, you know, state and local taxes, which are obviously another important thing for people, those tend to be very regressive, right? States tend to rely heavily on sales taxes. So overall, the whole sort of tax system in the United States is somewhat progressive, but much less progressive than most people would think.
You mentioned government borrowing. Is government borrowing on its way up? Is it down? Is it kind of holding?
It's coming down quite sharply. And I would argue it's coming down too sharply, right? If you think about it, you know, the U.S. Was hit with the worst recession, financial crisis since the Great Depression, and the Federal Reserve was very, very aggressive, and on interest rates and on trying to bring short-term interest rates down, and that was rather effective. And the sort of on the fiscal side, in 2009, 2010, when President Obama came in. Took some aggressive action, cut taxes, increased spending on roads and science, and really kept the economy from going off a cliff. But after a couple of years, you saw, partly because it changed the election, but a pretty quick shift away from that. And I think the shift was too quick towards more sort of austerity type. And I think you've seen spending sort of squeezed in the last few years. And the positive of that is that the budget deficit is coming down. Right, borrowing is coming down. It's the deficit has dropped dramatically. But on the negative side of that, I think you could argue that it's been a little bit too quick, right? The unemployment rate is still elevated, and the employment rate is still at recession levels, right? You still have so many people who just are not back to work. They're not necessarily counted as unemployed because they've been out of work so long and they've sort of stopped looking, but that employment rate is very, very low. And I would argue the U.S. should have been a little more aggressive longer, right? We should have built more bridges.
Well, and certainly driving around Pennsylvania and New Jersey and Delaware, there should be a lot of investment in infrastructure. Looking at the federal budget, is the government heavily invested in that or not?
Yes. So it is. And there was a bump up during the depths of the recession, right? So infrastructure is in that sort of last fifth of sort of hodgepodge of discretionary programs. Infrastructure is one of the larger ones of that. It's roughly, a fifth of that fifth, or 4%. It's a slice of that. But, the federal government plays a major role in highways and also in airports, right? And those, to the extent that you can sort of delay maintenance and delay investments, but eventually you have to pay up. And so it just makes sense to do that when you have so many, so many construction workers out of work, and you never get that time back, right? So really, when the economy is weak, that's really a time to sort of pick it up. And I think, again, the government, the president pushed that for a couple of years, but now you see he's proposing it again, and he's meeting more resistance on that.
What is your argument? I know you've heard this many times, which is that the government is supposed to live within its means and sort of balance its checkbook the way a family does. Although a family often goes into debt to buy things like a house or a car or send a child to college, but nonetheless, what's your answer to that argument?
It's one of the most damaging analogies. Yeah, but the government is not a family. The government is not a family. No, the government. The role of the government is to step in and to stabilize, right? The government plays a role when the economy, when markets overheat or they become imbalanced, the government offsets that. You think about unemployment insurance, right? If you have a town that, a factory closes and, all of a sudden a third of the workers are out of work, they have no money coming in, right? So what does that mean? They mean they can't go to the store, they can't buy clothes, they can't buy food. And so that reverberates in sort of, throughout the community. So the government comes in and says, okay, we'll provide, a holdover unemployment benefit. So those workers have some ability to spend, and so their job losses don't accelerate and affect other people. So the government plays a very important stabilization role. that's just not compared to a family.
You mentioned the fifth, the fifth, the fifth, the fifth, and fifth, and one of those fifths is defense. And I'm wondering, with the ending of the war in Iraq and the winding down of the war in Afghanistan, whether you see that becoming less part of the federal budget.
Right. So the defense budget, you know, ebbs and flows, like, you know, the parts. So you saw, you know, we had an 80s buildup, followed by the end of the Cold War, comes down, and then you have the Iraq and Afghanistan wars in the early aughts, and it goes up again, and now you see it coming down again. Right now, we'll see. You have all this, now you have this sort of tension around Russia. Who knows what effect that will have on defense budget. But, yes, you do see you're sort of in this sort of ebbing period where the U.S. is ramping down these, you know, in Afghanistan particularly, and that has been bringing sort of overall some of the funding increases, you know, that have been moderating, coming, you know, since it's been, the pressure has been subsiding a bit.
We have about a minute before I have to say goodbye. And just to underscore what we were talking about earlier, so the interest on the debt is about 6% of the federal budget?
Interest costs, or about 6% of revenue. Yes. And right now, right, because interest rates are relatively, are very, very low, which is, you know, an argument that this is actually a great time for the government to borrow money and to build roads and bridges.
And how low is the are the interest rates?
Oh, they're, you know, for the Treasury bills, I mean, the bottom line sort of Federal Reserve rate is about zero, but for Treasury bill rates, you're talking 2%, 3%.
Well, Chuck Maher, thank you for joining us and helping us understand where our federal tax dollars go. Thanks so much.
Oh, thanks for having me, Marty.
You're welcome. And again, that's Chuck Maher. He's Director of Federal Tax Policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. We also spoke with Rosalind Such about what filing can mean for same-sex couples. And we began with Aaron Arvaland talking about tax fraud. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. And you can find out much more about this program, including Facebook and Twitter, email archives, and the podcast. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.